Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, could a bill awaiting the governor's signature lead to more homes and less water use?
And the rise and fall of one of Phoenix's greatest high school baseball players.
But first, the Arizona House is expected to take up yet another budget proposal today, specifically the one approved by the Senate that had been negotiated with Governor Hobbs that won bipartisan support. This comes after the House okayed two separate budgets along party lines. Those plans were promptly vetoed by the governor after the Senate approved them in record time yesterday. It also comes as the clock on the fiscal year is ticking. It ends at midnight on Monday, meaning some areas of state government would likely shut down on Tuesday without a new budget in place. KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke has been at the state capitol following all of this. He's with me now to talk more about it. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday, because I will reference Spaceballs here. The Senate was kind of moving at ludicrous speed on passing budgets.
Yeah, it sounds like there was some sort of deal made finally to get all of these budgets moving. Basically, the Senate agreed, hey, House, we'll hear your budgets, because they had passed two, and in exchange for the House agreeing to introduce the Senate's version of the budget. So instead of holding robust debate, as we usually see, the Senate kind of just was like, hey, do y'all approve of passing all of this all at once? And they just kind of did it. And then, because everyone knew the governor was going to veto it, so there wasn't really a need to debate it much further than that.
Right. I mean, the governor had said that both of those proposals were not to her liking. So that leaves us with the House taking up, as you referenced, the Senate budget, which passed with both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. What is the plan for the House today?
Yeah, so the House did what's called the first read yesterday. So that's just basically introducing it, which they had refused to do since the Senate passed it in the middle of the night last week. And so today it's going to go through a process that will essentially allow lawmakers to make some final tweaks. I assume the House is going to make at least some minor changes so that they can say, you know, this has our fingerprint on it as well, rather than rubber stamping what the Senate Republicans and the governor negotiated. And then they could vote on that, you know, at 12:01 in the morning, based on rules that are require it to go kind of to the next day. But, you know, the rules are meant to be broken. So there's also a possibility that if they have enough votes, they could break those rules and pass it even before then. And then it would go back over to the Senate for that final approval.
So, Wayne, what changed? Like, why did the House and House Speaker Steve Montenegro, who steadfastly refused to bring this budget up, why is he doing it now?
That's the million-dollar question. You know, as a journalist, we love working on deadlines, and I think lawmakers are a bit the same way. So with that impending, you know, as you mentioned, June 30th shutdown deadline, I think that is becoming a reality for everybody. And a lot of this wasn't just about differences in budgets. I think it was about perceived disrespect. Mm. I think Speaker Montenegro felt he was being dictated to. That's what he said. The terms of a budget versus being an actual negotiator at the table. So I think the Senate agreeing to take up the House's budget, even though we knew it was going to be vetoed, went a long way towards at least, you know, I don't want to say cooling the temperatures, because there was still a lot of negative talk down at the Capitol yesterday, but at least helped them at least feel like they were being given the proper kind of legislative process. They, you know, hear our budget. Okay, it didn't go through. Now we can hear yours.
Yeah, well, you talked about sort of negative words at the Capitol. Senate President Warren Peterson didn't name any names, but it seemed pretty clear that he was not thrilled with some members of the House and maybe even some members of his caucus.
Yeah, he basically, as they passed the House's versions of the budget, he took an opportunity to speak and really lashed out at Republicans, who he said are just kind of going after this partisan budget, when the reality is that's never going to pass. You know, Senate Republican leaders have been saying this for a long time. We live in split government. We have a Democratic governor. We have to live within that reality. We like what your budget does, but we need a Republican governor to pass it. So he basically pointed that out. He used words like charlatans and things of that nature, yeah, to reference, as you mentioned, some unnamed members of both the House and the Senate, but basically said everyone needs to put their big boy pants on and realize that bipartisan budget is the only thing that's going to get the governor's signature.
So when you mentioned the process that the House will be going through today, today. One of the things you did not mention is the Appropriations Committee in the House, which is traditionally the time when the public can weigh in on any bill, but especially in this case on a budget. Does this mean that the $17.3 billion budget that the state will be operating under for the next fiscal year, assuming it passes, will have only one opportunity for the public to weigh in and that chance has passed?
Yeah. So House Appropriations Chair David Livingston was the chief kind of negotiator and champion of those two House budgets that went through, going as far as a few days ago saying this skinny budget we're pushing through that eventually got vetoed is the only thing I can support going forward. So now it looks like the speaker is just kind of going around him and not putting these bills through his committee at all. And as you mentioned, that's the time when, you know, it's usually a lot of lobbyists, but individual citizens are allowed to show up as well and kind of say, I like this, I don't like that. So yeah, that chance has passed. Basically what people can do now is email their representatives. Now, this is very similar to a bill that went through the Senate. So like I said, there might be some changes, so people were able to talk over there. But yeah, they are bypassing that one option to pass this. And it is the $17.6 billion budget.
$17.6 billion, yeah.
There's a lot of budgets going around.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to keep track. So I guess you mentioned the million-dollar question before. I guess another million-dollar question, or maybe the $17.6 billion question, does this budget have the votes to pass in the House?
Yeah, so Republicans in the House originally said we're not taking this up because it doesn't have the votes to pass. Now, that came a day after Livingston, that Appropriations Chair, seemed to say that it did have the votes to pass. So Democrats have repeatedly said this thing has always had the votes to pass. Minority Leader Oscar De Los Santos said the majority of his members are on board, which would get them pretty close. And then he said he believes there's enough Republicans on board to get it through as well. I tend to believe there is. You know, there were several Republicans who passed those previous budgets, but were not happy about it and kind of indicated that they would support something that looked more like the Senate's plan.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Lots to watch today and maybe into tomorrow as well. KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk. Grab a cup of coffee. Thanks for your help, Wayne.
Yep, thank you.
State lawmakers have sent to Governor Hobbs a bill that some supporters are calling the most significant piece of water legislation since the landmark 1980 Groundwater Management Act. The measure is known as the Ag to Urban Bill. It would allow developers to buy the water rights from farmers who are ready to move on from agriculture. The aim is to increase the supply of housing while at the same time using less water, since homes generally use less water than farms. With me now to talk about the potential impact of this bill is Kathleen Ferris, Senior Research Fellow at the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU. She's also a former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Kathy, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So I want to ask you, since you were a driving force between that 1980 Groundwater Management Act, do you agree with the assessment that this is the most significant piece of water legislation since then?
Significant in a negative way, I think.
Okay. How so?
Well, it's a developer-driven program that is supported by Big Ag as an excuse to mine groundwater to build new residential subdivisions in the exurbs of the valley. And I believe it will be to the long-term detriment of current Arizonans and our assured water supply program.
Is it, like, in the sense that farms generally, it's generally accepted that agriculture is sort of the big driver of water use, at least in this part of Arizona. If we are not using some of that water, but using it for homes that use less of it, is that not a net positive?
Well, it's positive in the short run. But let's face it, some of this agriculture would go out of business anyway. And remember that you're replacing them, these crops, with homes. Homes cannot be fallowed. Homes are permanent. And even the Department of Water Resources projections show that at some point, the benefit to the aquifer becomes negative as more and more homes are built and more groundwater is pumped.
Do you think that the negative will be longer out into the distance than it would have been if that water was continued to be used for agriculture?
Well, perhaps, but here's the rub, and it's really important to recognize this. Groundwater is a finite, non-renewable water supply. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of the Groundwater Management Act was to preserve it and conserve it. So an assured water supply, which is what is driving this whole program, was meant to be a sustainable, renewable supply of surface water and not groundwater. And under the Ag to Urban program, the responsibility falls on a replenishment district that was created in 1993 to replenish the groundwater pumped. Well, that replenishment district is already strapped. Their most current plan of operation shows that they're going to have to cut about half of the water supplies they thought they could rely on, CAP low priority water, because of the shortages on the Colorado River District. And now they're scrambling to find other water supplies just for the replenishment obligations they already saw, not including ag to urban. So we are chasing a finite supply of Colorado River water, a finite supply of groundwater, and at the same time, we're going to allow more growth on groundwater. It simply is not in the best interests of the state's water security.
What would be a better way to handle this, given the demonstrated need in the state for more housing? Like, how would it be a better way to go about providing that housing with maybe putting less stress on finite supplies of water?
Well, let me point out that this bill is to benefit the exurbs of the valley, like the Buckeyes and the Queen Creek. It's not for the benefit of the major cities in the valley, which are doing all kinds of things to ensure that they have an assured water supply. And what it does is it takes away from the need to develop renewable water supplies and to develop the infrastructure to bring those supplies into our state. And as long as we keep allowing growth on cheap groundwater, then we won't have the incentive to really make the investments that are needed to provide long-term water securities by bringing in renewable water supplies and building the infrastructure to deliver them.
This is happening at the same time as the State Department of Water Resources is looking at, you know, water purification, using recycled wastewater in more places. Does that not assuage your concerns a little bit that maybe there will not be incentives to develop these kinds of things?
You know what? That's already being done by the big valley cities like Phoenix, who look down the road and by the way, Phoenix probably has the most secure water supply of any city in the state. But they look down the road and they say, man, we've got to do something more. We see the shortages on Colorado River coming. We see the competition for groundwater. So we're going to invest in this very, very expensive process of treating wastewater to drinking water standards. It's important and it needs to be done, but it is a long ways off. And in the meantime, we'll just have more and more growth on groundwater. And by the way, the people who are growing on groundwater aren't contributing to those solutions of renewable water supplies or treating water to drinking water standards.
Kathy, you mentioned Queen Creek and the Buckeyes of the Valley, and those are, of course, areas where growth has not been able to happen after the Department of Water Resources sort of said that they didn't have the 100-year water assured water supply. Are you concerned that if homes are built in some of these areas on what used to be farms, that they might at some point run out of water?
Yes. But I'm also concerned about the existing residents. You know, I think it's really important to as KJAZ reported just this week, a new poll finds that Arizonans are deeply concerned about the Colorado River and groundwater, and they want officials to do more. And they want the state to prioritize basic needs and the current population. It can't all be driven by growth, but our policymakers, for the most part, don't seem to be listening.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Kathleen Ferris, Senior Research Fellow at the Kyle Center for Water Policy at ASU, also a former director of the State Department of Water Resources. Kathy, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good morning, it's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how trades, a new coach, and the draft may change the Phoenix Suns.
But first, this week, the bizarre saga of former Santa Cruz County Treasurer Liz Gutfahr reached a stunning conclusion. Gutfahr, who was convicted of embezzling tens of millions of dollars of public funds over a period of about 10 years, was sentenced to a decade in prison, followed by 3 years of probation. Daisy Zavala Magana, a reporter for Nogales International, has been following all the twists and turns of this case, and she joins us now. Daisy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for being here. As you reported in your piece on this, Daisy, the judge in the case, U.S. District Judge Rosemary Marquez, said she had reviewed all the evidence and found, quote, no reason for Gutfahr to have stolen all this money. But Gutfahr's attorney did try to persuade the court that Gutfahr had her own justifications for what she did, right?
Yes, he did.
And what were those justifications?
So he tried to paint a picture that she was, so aside from this embezzlement of $38 million of public funds, she was an otherwise honorable person, and that she was misguided by quote unquote delusions of wanting to live a lavish life, and some personal issues like depression and diminished capacity is what he was trying to paint for the court.
I see. Can you refresh our memories? What did Gutfahr say initially when this story broke? Was she always this introspective, at least by way of her attorney?
You know, not at all. It was radio silence on our end but I can understand, right, not wanting to speak to media. But
yeah.
What prosecutors highlighted was that during that initial interview with the FBI, she actually denied having stolen as far back as 2013 when they clearly asked if it stretched back all the way to that year. She actually said that it was just 3 months for an amount that essentially totaled about $1.5 million.
When in reality, it was, as you were just saying, 10 years. And what was the full total ultimately, about $40 million?
Yeah, well, it was originally around 39. And then as they did revisions, it was reduced to about 38.7.
Yeah.
Around there.
So a bit of a big gap there between those two versions of the story. One of the other things I thought was interesting from your piece is that Gutfahr's attorney, whose name was is Joshua Hamilton, I believe.
Yes.
He tried to pin some of the blame for what Gutfahr did on Santa Cruz County, right?
Yes, he did in his sentencing memo, which was filed ahead of the sentencing date. But in court, he emphasized that the responsibility solely lied on Gutfahr. But in that memo, he did highlight that the county had no oversight, little to no oversight, and that it has a long history of embezzlement scandals and fraudulent scandals, which is true.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the other things he said, if I'm not mistaken, is that she became Santa Cruz County Treasurer, despite the fact that she had no background or training in finance or accounting. Which is interesting, definitely, but she did run for the office, right? Did she put her own name forward for the position?
She did, and she ran unopposed and ultimately got the position.
So on the other side of this, you also had some comments in your piece from County Supervisor Rudy Malera. He said that he has known Gutfahr for 50 years. And I think it's fair to say that he didn't really buy these rationalizations for her behavior, right?
Yeah, he did not. He actually called her out for trying to manipulate the situation again. He said he didn't believe that she had severe depression that influenced her behavior or that she didn't know what was going on.
So in terms of what was going on, she embezzled this money, again, over a period of a very long time. Remind us what the mechanics were of how she was able to do this. How was she able to secret away this much money?
Yeah, so she created a lot of LLCs or companies where that she used to funnel the money out of, as an attempt to kind of hide that. And then she also falsified treasurer reports, reconciliation reports, and just a lot of other, I guess, mechanisms that would have served to help kind of catch this thing. But the other issue with that is that the county is being blamed for not doing their due diligence and having oversight and actually reading those reports or checking anything.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, I have to say, for somebody who notionally has no background or training in finance or accounting, it sounds like a fairly sophisticated operation. Is that something that the prosecution pointed out in all of this?
Yeah, the prosecution and ultimately the judge also pointed that as kind of a factor in why she decided to give out the sentence that she did.
So speaking of the judge, Daisy, this sentence that Gutfahr received was actually a little bit higher than what the prosecutors were seeking. Why did Judge Marquez increase the severity of the sentence?
So there was a little bit of discussion on whether or not there was what they call substantial financial harm to the schools and tax districts affected by this. There was an objection to that, but ultimately the judge ruled that there was financial harm because, you know, these entities have not been made whole. And while the school didn't have money for renovations for the children, Gutfahr was living very lavishly. She had 17 properties and a lot of luxury items.
Yeah. All right. Well, it seems like the end for now of a very strange chapter. Daisy Zavala Magana is a reporter for Nogales International. Daisy, thank you as always.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Mark, you are a New York Yankees fan, are you not?
Very much so, yes.
May I safely assume, then, that former Boston Red Sox slugger David Ortiz was a source of some torment?
Source of many nightmares, indeed, and many, many sad afternoons watching games.
I was trying to moderate that.
I appreciate
why.
That. Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
You're not alone. Ortiz, obviously, is one of the greatest home run hitters in baseball history. It was nigh impossible to get him out for many years of his career. But I don't know if you know this, there was one pitcher for my beloved Baltimore Orioles who had Ortiz's number. I don't know if you remember the name Brian Mattis.
Yeah, he was a left-handed relief pitcher, right?
That is right. Not originally, though. He was actually a top prospect for the Orioles back in 2009. And he was one of those guys who comes up to the major leagues with tons of hype, and then it just does not work out. He was supposed to be this amazing starting pitcher, but then he got hit really hard. They moved him to the bullpen, where he also got hit really hard. His one claim to fame, though, is that he was absurdly effective against David Ortiz, who, over the course of his career, got only 4 hits in 29 at-bats against Brian Mattis for a batting average of 138. And if you're an Orioles fan like me, this is one of those stories and stats that you carry around in your head, and it makes you feel like you know the story of Brian Mattis. But earlier this year, I found out just how little I actually knew about Brian Mattis. Back in January, Mattis was found dead of an apparent drug overdose at a house here in Phoenix. He was just 37 years old. And Daniel Allentuck, who is a beat reporter for the Baltimore Banner, recently wrote this extensive feature about the unraveling of Brian's life, which for me was an important wake-up call about who these guys really are. Among other things, Danielle told me that when Brian Mattis was in high school here in Phoenix, he was one of the best players his coaches had ever seen. So good, in fact, that they actually had to change the league rules.
So at the time, the playoffs were single elimination. So one win would get a team into the next round. And Brian Mattis started that one game for his team. He struck out 12. He hit a home run and kind of single-handedly lifted his school to a win and advancing in the playoffs. So the Arizona High School Association decided after that year that, you know, one singular player is not enough to advance the team to the next round. So they changed the double elimination. So the team had to win two games in order to advance in the next round because, you know, Brian was so good in that one game all by himself.
Wow, that's really amazing. Around this time, you found this quote that he gave to the Arizona Republic. And it's a very eerie quote, given what happens in your story. Quote, "I'm not neat off the field, but I am on the mound." That makes me think about the way that you characterize Brian's dad in the story. Tell me a little bit about what you found out there.
He was very hard on him. And he pushed his two sons to be the best baseball players that they could be. And that meant a lot of hours of work. So we kind of came to understand that baseball was Brian's identity. It was kind of all he knew growing up and into his 20s and 30s as he continued on in his baseball career.
Yeah. Well, at least initially, that was working out very well for him. He got drafted by the Orioles fourth overall in, I believe it was 2008. And once he got to the major leagues, he didn't have the success that he had been accustomed to in high school.
So Brian had always been a starter. It was what he identified himself as, but they moved him to the bullpen in 2012. And he saw that move as a demotion. You know, he identified himself as a starter. It's what he wanted to be. It's what he defined success as. And that's when you kind of see everything kind of start to go downhill for him. And 2014 is when you really start to get a look at some of the internal battles that he had. He had gone home to Arizona for the All-Star break and met up with one of his good friends. And he ended up taking Percocet, which is a very high caliber drug. And he took it for the entire All-Star break. And his friend had said, you know, if this is what he's like during the All-Star break, I can imagine what he's like during the season. You can't be pitching at a high level while also taking that level of a drug.
Yeah. And one of the really haunting moments of that sequence you were just describing, where his friend sees him taking Percocet, is that it seems to the friend, as you write, that Brian's goal in taking as much Percocet as he was taking was to fully disassociate. He says it seemed like he was trying to, quote, zombie out.
Yeah. And he did not see himself as a successful pitcher anymore. And when your entire identity is wrapped up in who you are in the field and you're not achieving there, he wanted to just try to erase it. He wanted to, you know, not have to think about it. The Orioles in 2016 traded him to Atlanta, who then essentially cut him. Brian did not believe that his career was over. He kept giving it, you know, additional chances. He signs a minor league deal with the Diamondbacks a year later, never makes it to the majors. A couple years later, he tried to go to Mexico. He tried to go to a different independent ball league. The way his friends describe it is he was just never able to let go.
So I'm a huge Orioles fan, and like I remember being so excited about Brian Mattis in terms of what he represented. I remember at the time he came up, he was part of what Orioles fans would call the cavalry. He was going to be, you know, one of, I think it was four pitchers at the time, who was going to come up from the minor leagues and return the franchise to relevance. And even after he was demoted to the bullpen and didn't always have very much success there, as you point out in the piece, the one thing he was really, really stellar at was striking out David Ortiz, who's a Hall of Fame designated hitter. And my friend and I would actually, every time we were watching a game and he would strike out David Ortiz, we would text each other Mattis faction. but the thing your piece made me think about was we had no idea who he actually was. As somebody who follows baseball players every day, do you feel like you have an increased sensitivity now maybe to what might be going on?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. And I can give you an example of a conversation I had with Trevor Rogers, who on Wednesday was returned to the majors after a really rough go around in 2024 with the Orioles after he was traded here. And, you know, we had had a long talk about how he had put a lot of pressure on himself. He only identified as a baseball player, he said. So when he wasn't playing well, it really weighed on him and impacted the rest of his life. He ended up going to see a sports psychologist. And because I had just done this whole story on Brian and mental health, I had a feeling, I didn't know for sure, that that might apply to him. And these guys go through so much. This is their lives. This is all they've ever wanted to do. And when it's not going well, it destroys them.
Yeah. Would you be able to say what it was about observing Trevor Rogers, the player you were just talking about, who, again, is, at least as of this recording, back up in the major leagues with the Orioles after being demoted to the minor leagues for a while to kind of rediscover his pitching skills? Was there anything in particular about him that, that gave you a suspicion that that might be a good question to ask?
So he had mentioned about how last year when he was sent down to the minors that it had really eaten at him, but this year he was better prepared. And I just had a feeling that that wasn't a conclusion that he came to himself, that he probably needed help. So we ended up, I just sort of straight up asked him, and I've covered other players who have been in high impact trades, who have spoken very openly about how much pressure they feel when they're in these situations. So I use that kind of as an intro for Trevor to show, like, you're not alone. And there are other players who have spoken about that. And he, you know, then went on to share about how, you know, he wasn't okay. He was not excited for spring training this year. He had to ask for help, or he doesn't think he would have the second chance back in the majors.
Boy, I have to say, you know, Danielle, I mean, thank you for sharing that. And I guess by extension, I really appreciate Trevor sharing that with you, because as a fan reading so much of the coverage of Trevor Rogers this year, there's been so much focus on the fact that, oh, well, he's rediscovered the velocity on his fastball. And I'm sure, you know, obviously from a practical standpoint, that's part of it. But that, you know, makes it sound like, ah, it was clearly just a conditioning issue or an arm angle issue or something like that. From what you're saying, it sounds like, yeah, maybe those things are true. But in tandem with that was the fact that he needed to be reminded that he was capable of throwing that hard and really reconnect with a desire to be able to do it.
Absolutely. And there was a great line that Trevor said, and I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it was something along the lines of, he has spent his entire life building up his baseball skills, that he needs to treat his mental skills the same way. Otherwise, his baseball skills don't matter.
Well, Danielle Allentuck is the Orioles beat reporter for the Baltimore Banner, and wrote this really affecting feature about Brian Mattis called The Unraveling of a Former Orioles Pitcher. Danielle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. It has been a busy few weeks for the Phoenix Suns. Last night, the team had the 10th overall pick in the NBA draft and selected center Kaman Maluach from Duke. They also traded for another center from Charlotte, Mark Williams. The Suns got that 10th pick as part of a trade with Houston this past weekend, in which they sent Kevin Durant to the Rockets. Durant had widely been expected to be traded this offseason. The Suns also got two other players and draft picks in the deal. And finally, there will be a new head coach on the sidelines this season. Earlier this month, the Suns hired Jordan Ott as their fourth head coach in the past four seasons. All of this follows a disappointing season for the Suns. They finished 10 games below 500 and missed the playoffs, despite having championship aspirations at the beginning of the season. With me now to talk about all this is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Brad, good morning.
Mark, good to chat with you.
Likewise, as always. So, let's start with the most recent last night. The Suns picked up a pair of centers. This seems like it was a need for them. They needed, you know, sort of a big man in the middle of the paint.
Oh, for sure. I think you could have made the argument they could have gone a different direction. Carter Bryant, just a first-year player at the University of Arizona, was taken a short time later. He's a wingman rather than a big man. Maluach, very intriguing player. But this is wait and see, Mark. I know we're going to get into this. This is all wait and see. You know, the Durant deal is not announced until July 6th. So we can talk about Dylan Brooks coming here and Jalen Green coming here and why they now have three centers on their roster. We can talk about how LeBron's agent is also representing Maluach. And you have to watch out when that sort of thing happens, because LeBron behind the scenes may want somebody to be involved. And then you have to look at Bradley Beal as the 800-pound elephant in the room. You know, the guy that said, "I control all the cards." One of the worst quotes in the history of Arizona sports. I've been here for 30 plus years, but when you look into a camera and your team's getting their heads kicked in and you're going to miss the playoffs and you look in the camera and say, I control all the cards, that's just selfish. I don't want that guy on my team in any way, shape, or form. And it's going to be a big buyout if they want to get rid of him. Point of all this rant is, Mark, this is wait and see. I know in our industry, it's easy to do what's the hot take today.
Yeah.
The hot take is not the smart take. The hot take is just simply that. It's being in the world's largest sports bar, which is social media. So everybody's got an opinion, even if it's the wrong one. I'm of the side of the street of let's just see how this plays out. It's June 26th when Mark and Brad are talking again on August 26th. I'm pretty sure this is going to be a different conversation.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems like maybe the question to ask now is, like, what direction are the Suns trying to go in? Because obviously they tried the big three with Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, and Bradley Beal. That clearly did not work. They have traded Durant. There's talk of potentially trading Devin Booker, although that seems kind of unlikely at this point. As you reference, you know, what do the Suns do with Bradley Beal, who has a no-trade clause? Do they go full rebuild? Do they try to sort of reload and win now in sort of a different conglomeration of players? Like, what direction do you think is the right one for the Suns at this moment?
Currently not the one that Matt Ishbia has taken. Right. Since he took over the organization, like I'll look at Oklahoma City, they just won a championship and Sam Presti, their general manager, he had a big three at one point in time, Westbrook, Harden, Durant. They won. They moved on. They broke them up. That's how it works in the NBA. You have to know when to break up a team. Jerry Colangelo was the best at it with the Suns when they were in their heyday, when everybody in the Valley and across the state was into the Suns. I think one of the big issues the Suns have right now is, who are these guys? You know, they don't know who these players are. What they hear is Bradley Beal's contract or Kevin Durant is out doing shoes or whatever. Fans want to see victories. Fans want to embrace. Like, I think the fans, Mark, are really going to embrace Malawach. I don't know if you saw his interviews last night, but he was flat out bawling about being taken.
Very emotional when he got picked.
Right. And he's a refugee of Uganda, went through the NBA Academy. He's walking down the street one day and a taxi cab driver says, hey, young man, he was 16. You need to get into Luol Deng's basketball camp with the NBA. Luol played in the NBA, had a cup of coffee with the Suns, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all started for him. So this is just a baby. He's not played basketball for, you know, very long, but he's 7'2". Can't teach size.
Yeah.
Right. His frame, he's only about 245. You turn him sideways, have him get a glass of tomato juice, he's a thermometer. So, you know, he's one of those players you look at. I think the fans will say he's not even 20. Let's embrace this young man. Let's see. Clearly, they can't have three centers on their roster. I mean, I say that, but I don't know with this owner. This owner is ready, fire, aim. That's what he is. Ready, fire, aim. We want Kevin Durant. We're going to get rid of Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, even though we're right on the cusp.
Yeah.
We're right on the cusp. But let's just, we got to sell tickets. We got to get excited. We got to get, and all fans want to see is, you know, let's go from Jordan Ott to Coach Bud to Vogel to Monty Williams. You know, when you have an organization that is stable, you're not turning over your people, or your people don't want to leave. Or when I go to the arena and I have people that say, you know, this isn't what it once was, well, then you should leave. The culture matters. You can talk all you want about being an NBA owner. I've seen plenty of sports owners, Mark. Unfortunately for me, I started with Donald Sterling. I started with the worst
with the
of
Clippers,
the worst.
Yeah,
the worst of the worst. And I've seen all sorts of bad owners. They're bad actors. They don't care. They just flat don't care. And I'm not saying Matt Ishbia is that. What I'm saying is he trying to hit the 10-run home run as an owner? Because there is no such thing as a 10-run home run. You need to take your medicine for a couple of years. You've run this thing into the ditch. Fans will embrace. Fans will show up in Phoenix. We love a front-running team, but we also like a team full of good guys. We don't like a team that has a player that says, I control all the cards.
Yeah. All right. Well, Brad, you and I will have to put on the calendar. We'll talk in a couple months, see if the Suns are going to win the regular season, not the offseason. That is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Brad, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Anytime, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. In 1973, after years of working odd jobs to keep the lights on, folk singer Jim Croce was finally becoming a star. He had recorded a trio of chart-topping hits that were getting heavy airplay: Bad Bad Leroy Brown, You Don't Mess Around With Jim, and Time in a Bottle. But then tragedy struck. The day before he was scheduled to release his next record, Croce was killed in a plane crash. He was just 30 years old, and his son, AJ, was only 2. The younger Croce, AJ, went on to become a successful musician in his own right, mastering boogie-woogie piano as a teenager and touring with artists like B.B. King, Ray Charles, and Willie Nelson, before finally launching a solo career. But as the 50th anniversary of Jim's death approached, AJ felt an urge to do something he had spent much of his life resisting: perform his father's songs. And so, for the last several years, AJ has been on tour doing this show called Croce Plays Croce, where he performs covers of his dad's music and tells stories about the family's unique journey through the music world. As AJ told me recently when we spoke a couple months ago, it's a way to connect with the man he never really got to know in real life.
My father was a prolific home recorder. Every time he practiced for new show that might be coming up, you know, he had a very brief professional career. It was 18 months. But before that 18 months, he'd play whenever he could on the weekends or whatever. So he would play a set according to what he thought that audience would want, whether it was a roadhouse or whether it was a you know, coffee house. You know, he tailored the set. And so I had probably over 100 reel-to-reels and cassettes of him at different times, from probably 66 on, of him hanging out with friends and playing songs and trying new things and writing new pieces of music. And so I got a sense of who he was as a person at home and the stories that he told and where it came from. You know, having lost my sight at a young age, I did get to know him, you know, in a way that a lot of people don't get to know their parent.
You know, I just had this thought, you know, like a lot of times when you're a kid, you know, your parent goes to work, but you don't really know what they do there or who they are. And there usually isn't a recording of it. Like, I'm just having this memory of going to my dad's law office for the first time when I was 8 or something and hearing him dictate a letter to his secretary. And I was like, that's my dad. Like, he talks like that. He knows those words. Who is this person? Was the experience of hearing your dad on these tapes anything like that for you? Or did it mostly match up with the perception that you had of him?
I think it was more kind of the other way around for me, hearing live performances of him when I got a little bit older and hearing the fact that he was so much the same on stage as he was at home.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Before we get to the part of your life where you started playing his music, I wanted to ask you about how you learned to play music. You mentioned losing your sight, and I've heard you say that something that you used to do during the period where you couldn't see was spend a lot of time sitting at the piano learning music. Can you describe how you did that? How did that go?
Yeah. So early on, you know, there would be someone that would show me a chord, and then they would say, do you hear how that sounds? And I would say, yeah. And then they would move my finger and they would say, do you hear how that sounds? You know, now it's a minor chord. Do you see how that feels different and sounds different? Yes. And then move my finger and say, do you hear that dissonance? You know, you're playing a chord that has a note in it that doesn't belong there. It was tonality. It was just in my head, in my ears. And so my earliest memories of that kind of thing were having a little transistor radio tuned in to like top 40 in the 70s, you know, hearing the Stones or hearing McCartney or hearing ELO or Elton John or, you know, whatever it was, and running to the piano to try and play along. And as my sight improved, I saw what I was playing, but I already had it in my head. I mean, to this day, I can play with my eyes closed, and half the show I do. It's just, I feel it.
I remember taking music lessons when I was a kid, and I was in the fortunate position of being able to see, and I'm realizing that so much of my experience of it was like looking for nods of approval on my teacher's face. You know what I mean? So I didn't have a very embodied experience of it, but I would imagine that would have been different for you.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to understand the fundamentals of what made a certain artist sound the way they did. And so when I was learning songs, for example, I was 15 and playing in bands, a lot of the people I was playing with, they were older, and they kind of learned the song, and then that was that. They learned the version note for note the way it was played on the record, and that just seemed wrong to me. The record was just, it just happened to be, and in my head, I always felt this way, the record was just that pass. It was not precious. And what was precious was the way it made you feel. And so the idea of playing other people's music for me was never about trying to copy them as much as it was about trying to find the essence of what was great about them.
Wow. So help me make a connection between what you were just describing, that sense of using someone else's recordings just kind of as a starting point, with something else I heard you say once, which was you said for a long time you were hesitant to cover your dad's music because, quote, I didn't feel like there was any integrity in playing my dad's stuff.
Yeah, I still feel the same way. I felt like when I started out, I could have taken that path. Not only did I want my own identity, but I also thought that like I would let people down by performing my father's music because some of these songs are so iconic. How do you not compare one person to the other when you're hearing them? You know, I thought back, I've been asked since I was 16 to record an album of my father's music. I still haven't done it, you know, but I love this show. What has happened is that they hear me through him and they hear him through me. And one of the most unique and beautiful things about this show is that people come because of nostalgia. They love the songs. They remind them of a place. They remind them of the partner, a husband, a wife, you know, their parent, their child they shared these songs with. And I become this three-dimensional personification of their memory, of their nostalgia. And when the music is actually playing, it brings it all to life in a way that's almost, it's almost surreal, but I'm there, but I'm present. And so my father never got to see my success, never got to see me grow as an artist, and never got to perform together. And so that was a sad thing. But the fact that I'm able to do it is the redemption.
That was A.J. Croce. He'll be performing his Croce Plays Croce show at the Musical Instrument Museum this Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday.
Well, Sam, hopefully we've not tugged on Superman's cape during this last hour of the show.
I did, I think, accidentally spit into the wind.
Yeah, that's not a good one. Yeah. No. Also, don't pull the mask off the Oval Ranger, right?
Yeah, and if you see anybody named Jim, I'd say steer clear.
Yeah, don't mess around with anybody named Jim.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. That'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.